Track 10. Norfolk Wildlife Trust Ambassador Nick Aitchison marvels at the wonders of winter on our coastline.
It's winter now, in late November. Today, though, is a rare day of perfect winter beauty. The sun shines low in a cold blue sky, and the colours of the land are freed from the sullen fog and drizzle of the season. I'm on the coastal path. It doesn't matter where, as the same scenes, more or less, could be seen anywhere along our glorious coast from home to Clye. South of me, inland, there are arable fields and grassland. To the north, there's salt marsh. Everywhere there is life. A salt marsh is a miraculous, counterintuitive thing. Coastal landforms need two conditions to exist, an energy source and a substrate. The coarser the substrate, the greater the energy required to move it. So, a beach made of heavy cobbles, such as Sheringham, forms where waves hit the land head-on, with energy enough to throw stones onto the shore. Long sandy beaches form where waves strike the shore at an angle, and their glancing energy is sufficiently reduced for them to drop grains of sand. Sand dunes, as at Winterton, Holcombe and Home, form where this sand is whipped up the beach by wind, not waves, and dropped behind an obstacle which breaks the wind's flow. Plants then do the job of building the dune by trapping sand and reinforcing it, physically and chemically, with roots and rotting leaves, all of which are carbon gathered from the atmosphere. Salt marshes are a paradox in that they require almost an absence of energy to form. Behind spits and islands such as Blakeney Point and Skolt Head, or at the top of long beaches, often behind ridges of dunes, salt marshes form at the very top of the tide, at the point where the tide turns. Protected from waves by a spit or beach, seawater has sufficiently little energy to drop its finest particles of silt. These, if they escape disturbance by the next tide or by a storm, settle to become a mudflat, which is colonized by algae, adding both nutrients and structure to the embryonic marsh. Next, samphire grows. Proper botanists call it glasswort, but in Norfolk it's samphire. Samphire traps more silt, raising the surface of the marsh, meaning it's minutely less exposed to the next tide, offering minutely different conditions to potential colonists, such as sea aster, cordgrass, and sea arrowgrass. This is succession. It happens in all habitats. In simple terms, it's the process by which the living beings in a habitat alter the physical conditions in it. Soil depth, soil chemistry, availability of fresh water and light, making it suitable for new species. In the idealized world of ecology textbooks, it moves neatly from one stage to another, with a discrete group of species at each stage. In a habitat as fractally complex as a salt marsh, shaped and reshaped over millennia by neap tides and spring tides, droughts and storm surges, sheep grazing and goose grazing, well, the reality is chaotic. It's geese I see grazing today. They're dark-bellied brents, which join us in their thousands each winter from western Siberia. I say they're dark-bellied, but Pacific brents, also known as black brants, which hail from northeast Siberia, Alaska, and parts of northern Canada, sometimes arrive in Norfolk and join them. Over a winter, a lost brant gander may form a bond with a young dark-belly female, and come spring will fly back with her to the Siberian tundra and raise mixed offspring. Such geese are very rare, but they are here, and they add to the marvellous wildness of our coast. Some geese are feeding in the salt marsh surrounded by curlews. Many more curlews are inland of the sea wall, in coastal grassland, among a rippling blanket of widgeon. Geese, widgeon, curlews, perhaps a few lapwings and golden plover too. These are the spirits of our coastal marshes in winter. Inland of the marshes, before the relentless tide of winter wheat and sugar beet begins, there is a thick old hedge. By November, its blackberries have gone. They fed October's migrant blackbirds, blackcaps and whitethroats. But there's plenty to eat here still. The hedges are red with rosehips and haws, and noisy with fieldfares and redwings. Like the geese, they're visitors from the north, bringing life and sound when much is mud and mist. I live for these wild days on our extraordinary coast, for the widgeon's shrill and the plover's tragic mew, for the wild wind, fractally complex too, one minute strafing my face and the next seeming gone, for the salt marsh and all the carbon, worms, mollusks and human history buried in its muddy depths. In today's world, these things, so deep in our Norfolk being, can't be taken for granted. Trapped between the hard borders we've imposed and the peril of rising sea level, our coastal marshes face an uncertain future. So too our wildlife and its freedom to flow across the landscape is threatened by habitat loss because of what people do and how we live. At Norfolk Wildlife Trust, we have for almost a century fought the loss of our wildlife and its habitat and striven to buy land and restore it where we can. Without you, the people of Norfolk, our members, donors and supporters, we can achieve nothing. We thank you for your constant support, especially at this time, for in the coming decades we will need it as never before.